the inside is right. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds of Change. This is your brain-wrinkling friend of the airways, Father Coyes, Father Tom Coyes. This is another Brain Wrinkling Wednesday. If you're listening live, it's a Brain Wrinkling Tuesday. We keep Father Anthony Bush in our prayers as he gets more of his treatment and checks up. I think he's up in Minnesota. Anyways, he's not in Chicago. That's it. We got our reward room ready to go. We also have our punishment room ready to go. I hope that door stays closed. This technology gives you a challenge, does it not, my friends? Well, when it all works well, it's an amazing thing, of course. So I'm going to try to continue a little bit of a discourse into areas I'm not very familiar with. That is science, physics, cosmology, biology. These are all things that occupy many people's minds, and they touch all of our minds to some extent. But I've always been more interested in, we say, the humanitarian sciences. Because humans...
Wow.
Always thought...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is brain wrinkling, for sure. I've always thought humans are the most interesting things to study. But the universe is pretty interesting, too. Things versus people. Anyways, history is a study of the actions of people throughout history, of course. Philosophy is the study of how people think. Biology is the study of living things. Okay, I know I'm getting a little basic here, and I don't want you to just turn off to look for something more brain wrinkling than you are hearing at present.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
We do need a bigger boat. Since I was knocking on the door of cosmology the other day, I'm going to knock on the door of another aspect of science that Stephen Mayer tackles in his marvelous book, Return to the God Hypothesis. Return to the God Hypothesis. And so if he's using science to try to challenge atheistic scientists about the origins of the universe, whether there was a Big Bang theory or not, whether there is a intelligent design behind the huge expansive billions and billions of light years wide universe. He also likes to tackle the tiny little small things, tiny little things called molecules, atoms, quarks, how life came about. He's going to challenge the atheistic scientists as well in a kind of similar way that what he does on the larger scale to the universe he's doing with the small scale stuff. With atoms, the elements of the universe, what is necessary for life itself? How did the first form of life happen in the universe? Where did it happen? Could it happen We know it happened on Earth, but we don't know that it happened on other places in the universe. I think we could be very faithful to our God, who is our Lord and Savior, God of the universe. I think we can be completely loyal to him and say, well, there might be some life out there. We haven't found any evidence of it yet. They keep searching for it. And so I'll keep an agnostic attitude about life out there. But right now, I don't believe there is. If great, strong evidence were presented, I might change my mind. Which brings up the issue of, oh, what about all the extraterrestrial stuff going on, flying saucers and whatever. There's a lot of mystics and even exorcists that are dialoguing with demons that say that extraterrestrial, ETs, extraterrestrials, can very well be demons. They could manifest themselves whatever they want. Yeah, that's really wrinkles your brain, doesn't it? They could manifest themselves whichever way they want, and they wanted to fool us, pull us along in one direction or another, especially if it's going to get us to deny God, that by darn, they'll do it. It seems very logical in my mind that that is a possibility, that those, that if there are creatures that are captured and hidden in Area 51 in Arizona, like so many people might say they are, they could be, very well be manifestations of demonic spirits. Okay, it could be. Could it be other intelligent forms of life out there, like everyone who watches Star Wars and Star Trek believes? That I cannot consent to.
You have to let it all go, Neo. Fear.
Show me some
doubt.
Yeah. Some kind of evidence that's, shall we say, irrefutable. And that's one of the things that's important about science today, is that a lot of times what is being presented as irrefutable is being refuted, or it is a hypothesis. That's actually why I think Stephen Mayer titles his book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. He wants it to sneak its way into universities and think tanks and wherever scientists gather, conventions and what have you. Let us propose this as a hypothesis, and I'm going to explain how it is the most reasonable hypothesis. It's kind of like when you're talking about the existence of God, and you say, well, I can't prove God exists, but I'll give you all these reasons to believe he exists, and my reasons are better than the atheist's reasons. Of course, if you know some good Thomistic, St. Thomas Aquinas, in his philosophy, he calls the five proofs for God's existence. They're very convincing, though scientists will take those. All of Thomas Aquinas's proofs for God's existence mimic or are related to what a lot of the theistic scientists today are saying is the intelligent design behind the vast universe or within the tiniest atoms and the question of the origins of life. So that's it's good to keep that in the back of our mind. And actually, whenever I try to teach, especially young minds, but good old anybody who would listen, about proofs for God's existence, I always like to start with the word proof, because it's assumed that everybody is on the same page when we talk about what we mean by a proof. But we're not. And I'm going to prove to you that we do have various meanings of the word proof. And to which of these various meanings of the word proof does the category, can you prove God exists, fit? Okay? Obviously, if you are going to do a proof of a simple scientific experiment. Let's say, at what temperature does water freeze? You put water in different temperatures, and when you see that it freezes at 32 degrees, you say, I've proven that water freezes at 32 degrees. And of course, there's other variables, but that's a proof, and
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, your scientific brain will accept that as a proof. Somebody might say, hey, I'm doing an experiment, and water is not freezing at 32. It's actually freezing at 33 degrees. And after you check your thermometer and your calibration of your temperature and all that jazz, then you discover, then the one scientist says to the other, where are you right now? And he says, well, I'm at my mountain cottage. How high is your mountain cottage? Well, we're at 14,500 feet. I think of the 14 because there's people who climb to the top of the peaks in the Rocky Mountains called 14Kers. People have wrapped up a bunch of summits to many of the 14,000 feet high peaks in the Colorado Rockies, anyways. And so the scientists, well, maybe there's something that affects the temperature, the nature of water, where it freezes at one level, less oxygen in the air, a higher atmosphere, a thinner atmosphere will cause water to. So you can see how a simple thing, a proof of scientific matter, like when does water freeze, can have its variables, and it can lead to other questions, and scientists are constantly diving into those other aspects. Correct? Correct. So that's one, and that's the basic meaning of proof that most people have in their mind when they say, can you prove this? But there's another kind of proof that we allow, we accept. It can be gotten wrong as well, but sometimes there's solid proof of something. And I'm thinking of how we use the word proof in a court of law. Someone's dead. Someone wants to find out who did it. You arrest a subject. You bring him to court. The lawyers for the prosecution present all sorts of evidence, and they say, we have proved that this person did it. And obviously, that's a different use of the word proof. But we accept it, and we know that we need something like that to keep society running smoothly. Can they get it wrong? Yes, obviously they can. Just like a scientist might get something wrong in his proof or so. But here's another version of proof that especially wrinkles my brain and especially touches on faith and morals and happiness and the meaning of life. And that is when someone says, I love you, and the other person says, prove it. Okay, now we all could conjure up the scenario of a teenage boy and a teenage girl, and the girl says to the boy, I love you. And the boy is going to take that phrase and say, prove it. And what the boy is thinking, and the boy uses that phrase, prove it, is in order to sleep with her. Let's just be blunt here. How many times that could be run astray? Okay, other than that, the idea of what is true love, or can I prove my love to you? It is a basic good question, is it not? Sure it is. Any two people who are thinking of marrying want to know if your words, I love you, are true. Prove it. And it's the third way we use the word proof or prove, much different than the scientific experiment or much different than a court case, right? But it's real, and it means a lot, and it's hard to figure out as well, right? We know it when we know it. And sometimes we're mistaken, of course. But it is real. To say that it is fake, to say that it is unreal, would be a travesty, would be a loss of one of the greatest things in life, of course, right? So that's one of the reasons why I like that movie, The Matrix. I've referred to that many, many times, and I think you know what I'm talking about. Remember when Neo, the hero, is shot by the bad guys at the, this is toward the end of the first episode, episode, and he's dead on the ground, and Trinity leans over him, and he says, "You can't be dead, because the Oracle told me that I would fall in love with the One, and I love you, therefore you can't be dead, you must be the One." She kisses him, and he wakes up. That's sort of the hidden power behind this third definition of proof, okay? That, my friends, all three of these kinds of proof are good when we talk about God. We could say, does God exist? Prove it. And we'll use some science. That's what we're going to do here a little bit today. We're going to use some scientific questions and evidence, observable facts from the world of science. We can also put God on trial, and we could say, is God real and behind everything? We can either declare him to be a fake or for him to be real. Most people who would say life is bad, my life is terrible, I hate my life, you know, the world is a sewer. A lot of those people would take that evidence as proof that God does not exist. I appreciate the messed up nature of the world just as much as anyone else, but I don't consider that to be the proof that he doesn't exist. I just consider that proof that man has turned away from God, and God allows the world to be affected by those who are against his will.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that is brain wrinkling. So let me before we turn to the question of the origin of life, and keeping a few basic questions in mind, how did life start? Is there evolution or not? Do we need a God hypothesis? Do we need a God principle in order to explain life? Obviously, many atheistic scientists say no. Stephen Meyer says yes. In order to explain how life came about, you've got to posit an intelligent designer behind the beginning of life, okay? So let's take a quick little break here, our first break. I'm happy to be with you on a Tuesday, as we're recording this on a Tuesday, but if you're listening on your podcast, whatever day it is, I hope I'll help you wrinkle your brain and give you something to pray about as we contemplate the great questions of life in the universe, right? Anyways, let's take that first break. I'm Father Tom Coyes. I'm guest host on The Winds of Change. You're listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ AM 750.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button, or visit Winds of Change Facebook page to see the Listen Live link.
Hey, I think that's me. That's my cue to start talking. And here we are. So I'm swimming in an unfamiliar field of academia, that being the field of science. I like it. I'm intrigued by it. I have sort of a new interest in it because some of these theistic scientists are challenging the atheistic scientists, basically.
But wait, there's more
attention to it. And but then just learning, trying to relearn or try to learn better or appreciate more accurately what we heard about in school at times, that in itself is delightful. There's a certain pleasure in learning, and it's a good pleasure. I actually often, as I suggest, when people are struggling with, shall we just say, you know, the impure temptations of life, I often suggest to them, try to cultivate your passion for learning. People who are passionate about learning can deflect the lower passion, shall we say, and it helps control some of those lower passions, shall we say, because there is a real pleasure for learning. To me, it's part of the passion and it's part of the frustration. You learn one thing and it brings up another question. You want to go deeper into it. It's very true about reading history for me. I like reading history, but every time I pick up a history book and read, it reveals a lot of things, but then I want to know more about the background about this. This happened. Why did it happen? And especially the interplay that is going on in the play, the great figures of history. What were they doing in their life? I'm especially curious about their romantic life and their faith life. Many times a bad romance could end up in a war, especially if the one romancing and the one romanced are part of two different warring cultures, right? That's the way it goes. So anyways, here's how I want to start. Maybe you've heard this voice. Can you determine who this is? Let's see.
Hello, I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson, your host for Nova Science Now. Can you imagine sitting down for a meal and getting served something that you know will taste so bitter, so vile, but it's really good for you?
So anyways, he's kind of popular on Nova, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's fun to listen to. I'm going to confess to that, because you learn lots of things about the universe around us. But he's often on PBS a lot, I think, for kids, and he can't resist, like so many scientists, of throwing their philosophy and their theology into their descriptions of the universe. It's one of the things about science that if you push it, you're going to end up with philosophy theology. And if you have a prejudice against theology, if you have a prejudice against the existence of God, you're going to do your best to explain things, and you come up with strange concepts. Like one of the strange concepts that atheistic scientists are proposing today is the multiverses, because we can't explain this universe without resorting to an intelligent design. Atheistic scientists oppose the idea of an intelligent designer, usually by the theory of random selection or accidental chaos in the universe and over an infinite amount of time, random things happen. You know, it reminds you of the comeback to that if you put a million or a trillion. Sometimes that's the number you see when they're talking about either tremendously large numbers or tremendously small numbers. If you put a trillion monkeys at a trillion typewriters and you loaded their typewriter up with paper and you taught them how to start punching the keys, would they come up with a Shakespeare play? Would one of them, just by accident, do a four-act, 500-page drama that makes sense? The answer, of course, is no way. But that's the kind of thing scientists are asking us to believe, instead of some kind of intelligent designer behind the universe, okay? Before I read a couple of things from Meyer's book, I should do a whole show on this, but some of my friends know, and one of my friends gave me a Far Side calendar, and I enjoy looking at it now. I tell myself, only one cartoon a day. Don't go zipping through the whole thing. Here's one that caught my attention just from the other day. And I'll try to paint a picture of the cartoon, because this is a radio show, right? And you can't see it. But if you know Far Side, you know how Gary Larson paints sort of crude pictures, sort of like a cartoonist. They're not realistic depictions of the scene, but they're fun. As a matter of fact, I think if they were realistic pictures, you could take the same narrative, shall we say, and turn it into a photograph, and it wouldn't raise the chuckle that it does with you when you see a cartoon, that non-realistic shape of the beings sort of makes you realize it's coming from a human's head, a human's mind. And so you're trying to figure out what's in that other human being's mind. And so anyways, here's one. There's a farmer, looks like he's holding a rifle, but it's clear that the farmer is not a real farmer. It's a cutout of a farmer with his hoe. Another one has a rifle. You know how, like, sometimes you see on the road, like a man leaning up against a post. And from the corner of your eye, it looks like there's a man leaning against that post. And if you get closer or you look at it more closely, you see that it's just a flat cutout. Anyways, in this cartoon, there's a several farmer-type looking guys with their 10-gallon hats, their Amish-looking beards. But they're not real farmers. They are cutouts, and you can see that they're being propped up by a piece of wood behind them. And they're standing in front of a house, but it's not a real house. It's just a cutout of the front of the house, like a lot of movie studios used to do. I have to smile because I'm visiting with my wonderful, precious aged mother, we try to look for fun things to watch, and she has a hard time following, you know, a complicated movie. So I resort to watching a lot of Lone Ranger episodes. I figured Lone Ranger is pretty easy to follow because Lone Ranger wears a white hat. The bad guys almost always wear a black hat. Lone Ranger is always the good guy, and he's always chasing the bad guy, and he always gets his man, or women sometimes. Anyways, when they made Westerns like that, they would often build the little Western town. The camera would pan, and you'd see the front of the buildings. I remember being in California once. I think I went to Universal Studios, and you were able to see some of the fake towns. You know, wait a minute, those aren't real buildings. They're just fronts made out of plywood. One of the more precious movie or TV scenes I remember discovering is that I saw the actual pond where Gilligan's Island was formed, was played. Wasn't at a remote island in the middle of the Pacific at all. It was a small pond in the back of whatever Universal or MGM Studios. And it just blew your mind. It's like, that's the lagoon where the SS Minnow washed up after its three-hour tour. Anyways, so here's the cartoon, the Far Side cartoon. That's the picture. These cutout farmers standing in front of a cutout barn. Can you imagine what the subtitle is? Can you imagine what the caption says? The caption is, "The Fake McCoys." Makes me laugh. I hope you get to see why it's funny. Humor is often a play on your mind, something you don't expect, because we all know the phrase, "the real McCoys." I always have been captivated by that phrase because my last name is Coys, but so who's the real McCoys? No relative of mine, I don't think. But anyways, so we think of the real McCoys. So where are the fake McCoys? Well, we just found them. There they are. That leads to the science topic that we have. Science is always supposed to be about discovering what is real. And if something is discovered to be fake, you'd think of it as non-science. And so that's what this wonderful book about the origins of the universe and the origins of life here, it's trying to develop, it's trying to promote the fact that if you study the universe, the world around us, the biggest and the smallest aspects of it, you're going to unlock secrets of the universe that are real. And learning more reality helps, can very much easily shed proof or evidence for God. Okay, so that's where we're at. Here, let me read this one. Here we go. From the origin of life and what's called the DNA enigma. Of course, modern scientists know what DNA is. Even earlier, modern scientists didn't know what DNA. That's the map of the incredibly complicated genome molecule, I guess you can call it, the double helix strand, shall we say, that has all sorts of what they call nucleotide bases. Anyways, okay, here's where we're going to start. Since 1859, the appearance of design in living things has been understood by many biologists as a powerfully suggestive illusion, but an illusion nonetheless. The evolutionary biologist Francisco Alaya has argued, Darwin's theory of natural selection accounts for the design of organisms and for their wondrous diversity as the result of natural processes, the gradual accumulation of spontaneously arisen variations or mutations sorted out by natural selection, a process that is creative, although not conscious. So he's sure you know that Darwin's theory of evolution, that the amoeba grew into another little multi-cell organism. Then we had a worm, then we had a snake, then we had a lizard, then we had, or if it started in the water, a fish that crawled out of the water, et cetera, you know. And all of us have seen, and it's probably still in almost every grade school, the progression of an ape standing up, the drawing where the human being is on the right and the ape is on the left, and through different stages. Okay, that's Darwin's theory of evolution, right? I feel I got to just explain some of these things in basic forms, lest some of my listeners get lost, as it were. This reminds me, I'm looking at another Far Side cartoon right here. I got to laugh. Here we go. Here's the picture. There's a professor, obviously, with his little tie and his pointer, pointing at a large chalkboard. And there are a bunch of students, mostly elderly, heavyset students, mixture of men and women. He always draws the women with funny little dresses on, as it were, or they're always kind of round people. Anyways, the professor is standing there in front of his chalkboard, lecturing the people. And on the chalkboard, there is a large screwdriver and a large screw, only two things on the blackboard. And he's pointing out how, in order to turn the screw, you put the screwdriver in the slot of the screw and you turn it. So that's the picture. What's the caption? This is the school for the mechanically declined. A lot of people say, I'm not mechanically inclined. So what's the opposite of mechanically inclined? You say, wow. I'm mechanically declined.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Anyways, so we'll get to the origins of life here, but here we go. So Richard Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, a noted atheist, of course, is even more blunt than Francisco Alaya. He says, he defines biology as the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So they recognize all this interesting design, complicated things, more than a screwdriver and a screw, but the cells, the human cells, the makeup of all the atoms and elements of the universe, shall we say. And that's just an appearance. It's people who want to believe there's a designer behind it. We're the ones stretching the mind and saying, impossible, or impossible to believe without a creator. And they're the ones saying, no, it could be explained just by random selection, accidental bumping into each other of molecules and what have you. Okay, let's. I want to get into that. Now we're getting into some of the science here. So we'll take our next break. And I promise you, I'll try to wrinkle your brain about this, because it certainly wrinkles my brain. And it causes me to praise the God of the universe, praises me to believe in a God who is such a perfect designer. There must be a great plan. It's not chaos. Life is not random. There's meaning, purpose, a goal, all these good things. So, okay, let's take our next break. I am Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change. We are the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ AM 750.
St. Stanislaus Kostka. The Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy is open 24 hours a day, 7 days per week, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in the iconic monstrance. The Blessed Sacrament is reposed during the celebration of Mass and during special events. St. Stan's doors are always open for adoration. Come anytime, day or night. St. Stan's is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, right off the Kennedy. Visit ststanschurch.org.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
Listeners to Catholic radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I think that's my cue again here. Okay, let me try to throw some science at you as far as why it is much more reasonable to believe that an intelligent being was behind the origin of life. And we're going to, in a general sense, pit the believing scientists against the unbelieving scientists, believing in God, that is, or not believing in God. With a certain problem, this is what you can use at your cocktail parties. The creation of the carbon molecule, and something that's called the fifth level crevice. Try to remember that one. The fifth level crevice. That's what I'm going to try to get to here. So all scientists agree that you can't possibly have life if you don't have the molecule, or you don't have the element carbon. Carbon is one of the most basic things in all forms of life. And if you don't have a carbon element, you won't have life. Rocks don't have, carbon can have, there can be some carbon in rocks, but not necessarily, right? There's many kinds of rocks that don't have carbon. As a matter of fact, that's many of the rocks, the prettiest rocks, I'm going to have to say, are those crystals. Do you ever go to a rock store and you marvel at the beautiful different kinds of rocks? And a lot of the rocks that have colors and that are transparent are crystals. And those generally don't have carbon in them. Okay, so starting with the idea that there's lots of elements in the universe, you have to explain the scientists call them lighter elements transform or create heavier elements. And scientists, as they try to scour the universe, have long since accepted the fact that the universe, that the most prevalent elements in the universe, which indicate, especially if you take the Big Bang theory, where if there was an original egg of matter, the most prevalent elements in the universe, the three are helium, hydrogen, and beryllium. Helium, hydrogen, beryllium. And those are three very prevalent elements in the universe. And not just by a little bit, but by lots. I don't know. I can't remember exactly. 80%, 85, 75, something. There are, of course, many other elements in the universe, but helium, hydrogen, and beryllium are very dominant. And so, but they're very light, and scientists weigh or quantify, I don't know if I call them an atom or an element, by the number of protons. So they only have, those three only have one proton, so they're given the weight of one, okay? And the scientists can agree that through a random bumping in or accidental encounter, sometimes two simple elements will combine to make a little bigger element, you know, of a weight of two. It's not an obvious thing, but it can happen. Scientists accept that very, very agreeably. And so, but the carbon element has a weight of 12. And so the theistic scientists are saying, you atheistic scientists are going to have to explain how in the building of simple elements to the complex elements of carbon, which is necessary for life, in your random bumping in together. And scientists often say, well, if there's an infinite amount of time, even something that's very unlikely, well, would or could, probably did happen. So the elements of weight one collide and accidentally to form elements of a weight two. And so the theistic scientists are going to say, okay, yes, that's true, but go from two to three to four, four to five, from five to six, then you got to get to six to seven, seven to eight, eight to nine, nine to 10, 10 to 11, 11 to 12 to get to carbon. And that, of course, is not a being, but it's at least an element necessary for life. The theistic scientists are going to say, we all know that the jump from five to six in the weight of an element is requires a certain kind of an part of the atom known as a quark. Quartz? Quark? I think they call it a quark. They're all agreement on that. And they know that some of these quarks that are part of the life of an atom have very short lifespans. And here's the crazy thing about the elements. To go from five to six weight requires a certain kind of quark that everybody knows is super, 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 super short-lived, which is important in when you're going to calculate the random accidental bumping into another element that is exactly right in order for it to jump from the fifth to the sixth level of weight. Are you following me? and that's why it's called the fifth crevice. How do you jump over that barrier, as it were? Because the quark that's necessary for that jump, its life is so short that they've calculated the lifespan of that quark to be a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. It's very short, right? If you say, I'll be there in a second, well, that means you're going to try to be there right away. Or you say, oh, it's a half a second. Or like when we watch baseball and we see how fast the pitch was.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
It was 89 and 4/10 of a second. Or when, you know what, when you really see that is in race cars or in horse races, I guess, and when, or even in an Olympic track race, the winner and the first place and the second place contestants are often separated by 10ths of a second, or even 1/100th of a second, maybe 1/1000th of a second, if you got three digits after a zero. Okay, but imagine a trillionth of a second. That's really short. But the scientists, don't stop there. They call it a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. I can't even just imagine. It's like it's non-existent. So this atheistic the theistic scientists challenge the atheistic ones by saying, okay, that lifespan of that quark needs to bump into another such atom, element, at specifically the right time. So that it is such a short lifespan, it is very unlikely to happen. Well, and then the atheist scientists will say, well, you got an infinite amount of time. Though many scientists will say, well, the universe doesn't have an infinite amount of time. We, even with conservative estimations, they'll say, well, the universe is maybe 7 billion years old. And so, and remember, trillion is bigger than a billion. So if that were to be accidentally bumped into, there's not enough time, or the chances of that accidental bumping into each other is so infinitesimally small that it's like the chances of it happening are zero to none, or 0.00000000001 chance of it happening. And there's just not enough time in the life of the universe for it to have happened, for the molecules to build up and have gone from the weight of 5 to 6 to 6 to 7 to 7 to 8 to 8 to 9 to 9 to 10, 10 to 11, 11 to 12. Bingo, you're at the carbon molecule. So it's almost unreasonable to think that we got carbon from chance happening. As a matter of fact, here's another aspect of what the theistic scientists are challenging the atheistic scientists with. Say, okay, the Big Bang, which we're going to, for a moment, accept happen, and even some atheistic scientists are agreeing that evidence looks like there was a Big Bang. At the beginning, when that they call it sometimes the primordial egg of matter, so dense that all the matter that is now in the universe was compact into a tiny speck, shall we say. And of course, I, the believer in God, says, well, who put that speck there? You know, it's a good joke to share with anybody if they're interested in trying to prove God's existence. And an atheist will always say, well, an atheist and a theist were arguing about the origins of the universe, and the atheist says, well, it's simple. At the beginning of the universe, there was this small egg of matter, and it exploded. And then the theist will say, what do you need to start that little egg? Well, you need all the elements, you squish them together. So you just say, well, get your, if you think you could create life by yourself, then do it. Okay, well, then the atheistic scientist will say, okay, I just need, can you give me some of that elements that we're talking about? And the theist says, no, get your own elements. Get your own dirt, sometimes it's said. Okay, to me it's a great pointing to the intelligent design behind the universe. That small, infinitesimally small, pre-explosion egg of matter, scientists say it had to be made up of the proper calculation or percentage of elements, if it, in other words, if it had too much helium or not enough beryllium, it would have exploded in a much different way, because we know that those kinds of elements react in a certain sense. If the Big Bang exploded too fast, it would throw the elements way out into space in such a way that gravity wouldn't have worked on those elements to pull them together, as it were. Or if the Big Bang was too slow of an explosion, the elements wouldn't have gone out into space fast enough, and therefore gravity would overcome all that matter. So either if the proper composition of the egg were different and the speed of the explosion were different, the universe wouldn't exist as it does today, because either all the planets would be flying away infinitely into nothing. There was, planets wouldn't revolve around each other, galaxies wouldn't stick kind of together. So either there'd be a universe that didn't have planets, matter would just have split up, or else we'd have a universe that was just essentially a big black hole, where the matter would collapse upon itself. And so the fact that there was exactly the right amount of elements in that primordial egg, that the explosion exploded at the right speed, any little difference would have ruined the universe as we know it now. Then, of course, you need the universe as we know it now to have been able to create carbon as a building block for life. We don't know, again, we don't know if there's other elements, other living beings in other parts of the universe. So we're going to assume that the conditions here on planet Earth were the only ones that were calibrated and designed by some wise being, which we're going to call God, that allowed life to begin. So let me read just a little bit more here. We bring in the DNA enigma from carbon to the small elements of life. You get all life forms have DNA, and DNA is made up of it's a store and transmitter of information. Let's see, it was two scientists by the name of Francis Crick and James Watson. Elementary, dear Watson. So, oh dear, it's the end of our hour. Okay, we're gonna have to just continue our lovely exploration into science to help us really love the universe and the God behind it. It's very good if we do this, because it'll help those who are struggling with their faith to know that it's reasonable to put your faith in God. I'm Father Tom Coyne. You've been listening to The Winds of Change, the new EWTN Catholic radio voice for Chicagoland, WSFI 88.5, and WNDZ AM 750.
It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The